If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 565. Man, shit's crazy. With guest Ben Burgess. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Thursday, October 29th, 2020. Yes, there's an election coming up. I recorded this just a few minutes ago, actually. We wrapped up just a few minutes ago. And I'm putting it out immediately, well, because, you know, the election. It's topical. Apologies to the guest who I recorded an interview with a couple weeks back on psychedelics. That interview will be forthcoming in the near future. But for now, here's me talking with Ben Burgess. And for those of you who don't know, Ben Burgess is one of the stable of writers over at Zero Books. That's the imprint that Doug Lane manages. And I know of Ben through Doug Lane. I've spoken with Ben before when I had a live radio show. And Ben has just recently appeared as a guest on The Daily Show Rising, which apparently I like better than he does, even though he likes it. I really like it. And I'll say that at the beginning of the interview. So what you're going to hear is mostly unedited. I've trimmed out a couple minutes of just idle chit-chat at the very beginning, but other than that, this is an unedited interview for, well, ease on my part. But Ben knows how to handle himself. There was nothing that needed to be trimmed or tightened up. It's all good. So, here we go.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm speaking with Ben Burgess. And Ben, I was just looking at my email history with you. The last time we spoke, it was on live radio. This is in the very comfortable domain of the pre-recorded podcast, but welcome.
Good to be back.
I saw you on Rising recently, and I watch Rising, as the listeners know. I watch every day. I at least watch the first three segments. You know, I watch the opening segment. I watch Crystal's Radar and Sagar's Radar, and then, you know, if there's good stuff, I'll fish around for the good stuff. But it's so bizarre to have so much of the general public and the mainstream media, the corporate media, NPR. They've just gone insane, like literally off the deep end, nuts. And then at the same time, here's Rising, which is a show with some backing. It's got production polish. You know, it looks good. It's the sort of thing that you can send to somebody who's used to watching, you know, corporate news, and it looks like corporate news, so they'll watch it. You know,
right.
But this is frightening for me. I agree with like 90% of what Crystal and Sagar say on the show, even though Crystal and Sagar probably don't agree with one another 90% of the time.
Right, of course.
So the math doesn't quite work, but it's really weird to have just a polished source like that, that is saying things which are forbidden in the mainstream media and with which I really resonate. This is, you know, I'm 52. This is a unique experience in my whole half century of existence.
Yeah, no, I'm a fan. I don't watch it as much, I guess, as it sounds like you do, but, you know, it's something I'll put on, you know, kind of the way that I used to, you know, that I put on like the Majority Report or something, is like if I was going to be eating for the next 10 minutes and I just wanted like something to be on, you know, while I did it, you know, and, to get a little bit of news, you know, while I do it. I think it's actually a really interesting, like, I don't know, Rorschach test almost, you know, because there are people who I agree with about most things and who I suspect agree with at least Crystal about almost everything, who just obsessively hate that show. And like it's like they'll have these like 2 minutes hates about it. And I think it's a really weird, like unhealthy sign because, you know, I mean, there's some stuff Sagar thinks, obviously I really disagree with, but it's also like, you know, it's a talk show, right? I mean, it's not like the way that people talk about it sometimes is it's almost like do you support the formation of a Crystal Ball, Sagar and Jetty coalition government or something? It's like, no, it's, they're just talking about the news, you know, like, and, you know, they'll say some things you disagree with and some things you disagree with, you know, calm down.
Yeah. Oh, I have to say, I have to skip the any segment that involves marijuana, because I just, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, really. I was born in 68. I was a teenager in the 1980s. That's really where my, you know, the person that I am now, the roots of that person came about in the 1980s. And in the 1980s, I was hanging out with artists and drag queens and, you know, black people. And I was living in Kansas City, Missouri, and the Republican establishment, the conservative, you know, just the social conservative establishment of society was morally righteous. They thought they were morally superior than their opponents, and they thought that it was appropriate to use the power of the federal government and state governments, whatever power was at hand, it was appropriate to use that power to force other people to either agree with you or pretend to agree with you. And that was so odious, so obnoxious. And now it really seems like the roles have flipped, and it's the left that is really bent on using their power to coerce other people, and they feel great about it because they believe themselves to be morally righteous, you know, to be coming from a morally superior position and inflicting righteous, you know, correction upon moral troglodytes, which, you know, for me is no different at all from how, you know, I was seeing the Republicans back in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, not necessarily Republican you know, elected officials, but more like community leaders and people speaking from that position of, you know, absolute moral authority because we've got God on our side. You know, the blue tribe doesn't have God, but they're no less righteous. And it's I'm encountering more and more sort of defectors from the blue tribe who've really gotten burned. I talked to one just recently who didn't do anything really awful, you know, from a blue tribe perspective. At least to me, it seems like she didn't do anything awful. She, you know, she chided her boyfriend for his white privilege and then, you know, realized, oh my God, my boyfriend has lived such a hard life. You know, he's been knocked around. He's been to prison. His white privilege didn't buy him a cup of coffee. And so she sort of backed off on, you know, the really righteous, angry, hectoring rhetoric. And just backing off from it a little bit caused her blue tribe community to notice that she had departed, you know, from the program, and they came down hard on her. So now she's like divorced from social media and really angry at the whole world, and has, I think, latched on to some voices that, like, I'm not a huge Tim Pool fan. I nothing against the guy. It's just his. People who have to articulate a position all day, every day, get caught up in it. And, you know, that's just how it is. And when they get caught up in it, they tend to get more extreme. And, you know, the more extreme, you can even be, you know, extremely heterodox. You can be, you know, you can be just out there on the fringe in terms of your rejection of everybody else who's out there on the fringe. And you just, you got to take a break. And, you know, Tim's one of those people making so much media, he kind of, you know, he goes down the Alex Jones slippery slope of, I'm just blathering into this microphone all day and who knows what's going to come out. And the stupider, crazier it is, somebody's going to like it. You know, so.
Yeah, right. This. I mean, like, and I guess there are a couple things there because I think that something that people feeling defensive about some of what you're talking about will say that I think is true. Is okay, so sometimes you know, progressives and leftists can be extremely annoying about this shit, but like, is this really the most important, you know, thing thing going on in the world, right? And then especially when you're talking about people who fall down this kind of you know, Tim Poolish rabbit hole, right? Like, you know, you're maybe supporting political forces that are actually trying to do, like, you know, really serious, really bad things with very bad, you know, consequences in the real world. And so something has gone wrong in this calculus because you're, you know, it's like, okay, people being annoying, like, you know, think about, like, you know, the 5 or 10 worst things the, you know, Trump administration has done in the last 4 years and compare those to, you know, people being annoying on Twitter, and it's clear which one wins. And I agree with that, you know, as far as it goes. I think that's right. But what does frustrate me is that oftentimes people don't split up the questions and say, okay, sure, fair enough. But also, if we're acting in ways that predictably tend to drive people away and then lead them to, you know, lead them in those directions politically, then is that a good thing? Is that a counterproductive thing? Should you stop doing it, you know, because it's having the opposite of the effect that you want? And unfortunately, I feel like oftentimes those follow-up questions never get asked, right? Because I think so much of this, I think what your kind of analogy about, like, the evangelical right in the 80s maybe brings out is that so much of this stuff isn't really even about, you know, politics, strictly speaking. It's about proving your own individual moral rightness and having it validated, you know, by others, which is oftentimes something that doesn't really go in the same direction as is something that, like, you know, sometimes you have to pick. Right. You know, which one you want. Right. Like, do you want to have other people recognize you as a member of the club, that, you know, that you're extremely righteous, you know, you're going to heaven, and then, like, really sharply differentiate yourself from the people who are going to hell? Is that your goal? Or is your goal to, you know, to change the world in some sort of positive way? Right. So a very small example of this that I've been kind of obsessed with since, because I thought it was so telling, was back in January, I guess, right, when Bernie Sanders, you know, was about to win the Iowa caucus, and there were people who freaked out because the most popular podcaster in the world, Joe Rogan, said some nice things about him, and then, like, he did what any competent campaign would do and clipped the video of Joe Rogan saying the nice things about him and then, you know, put it on his Twitter feed. And I saw people reacting and saying, oh my God, you know, Bernie Sanders is touting the endorsement of this horrible person, Joe Rogan. And even though I'm sure a lot of that, well, I know a lot of that was, you know, ginned up by, you know, supporters of other candidates, but I was also seeing people with that, you know, Democratic Socialist Rose of emoji, you know, in their Twitter feeds who were going along with this. Oh yeah, he really shouldn't have done that, right? He really shouldn't have touted that endorsement from Joe Rogan.
Touted that endorsement from the most popular podcaster in the world.
Yes, that's right. That, like, if you're in an election where the goal presumably is to get more people to support you than to support the other candidates, then what you should have done is either said, you know, said no, right? I refuse your support because you're a bad person. I don't want bad people to support me, or at the very least, like, I don't know, like, remain silent about it. Like the whole thing was just bizarre, but I think it's a telling detail, right? Like, it's something that I feel like I've seen a lot, and I've maybe even seen more of this year. I think particularly since the beginning of the pandemic, you know, even though that example is a couple months before that, I think that a lot of people spending a lot more time indoors, in combination with the way that the Trump experience has broken so many people's minds, and in combination maybe with some of the post George Floyd unrest, you know, where people felt, I think, justifiably angry and frustrated with their inability to change real political institutions, you know, so you could actually change the way the policing works. But I think that was very often taken out in these weird ways, you know, that, like, what would a strategy actually look like to get, you know, to get to a point where, you know, local police departments didn't buy or weren't sold surplus military gear, or what would a strategy actually look like, to, you know, to really change, like, even on a local level, like the procedures for, you know, for firing, you know, police officers, anything like that, right? Like, even as you ask those questions, you can see, oh my God, that's incredibly hard, right? Like that those would be hugely difficult political lifts to do any of that stuff. Whereas if you can, if all you're trying to do is to get people to change the name of something, or to you know, pressure some small business owner into issuing a symbolic statement of support, you know, saying Black Lives Matter, or all you're trying to do is like get somebody fired from, you know, a media company or something. Those things are really easy, right? Yeah. Where all that other stuff is really hard. And so I think just that path of least resistance in combination with the pandemic, in combination with the Trump stuff, has led to some of what you're talking about being, you know, I don't know if it's an all-time worst, but certainly it's probably not, right?
No.
But it's certainly, but I think noticeably more severe than was the case not that long ago. I think I'd plant my flag there.
It's the all-time worst that it's been since I've been paying attention. Like, when the Republicans were morally righteous and looking to coerce people who didn't agree with them in the 80s, you know, there wasn't the internet, there wasn't the web, there wasn't social media. There were three broadcast networks that all had basically the same news on. And there was just a level of cultural cohesion and, you know, worldview agreement that we no longer enjoy. And there was the Soviet Union, which is huge. It's hugely important.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Still, you know, a threat. I watched The Day After Tomorrow, you know, when I was a sophomore in high school.
Yeah.
You know, the world could end at any minute and we had to have some, you know, rational level of group identity, and that's gone. That's so gone. And
yeah, I mean, of course all of that definitely functioned to make you know, I mean, all of those things that you're talking about, especially the part about the Cold War, did definitely, you know, serve to suppress a lot of dissent, and I think it is true that we maybe forget how bad some of that was, right? So, you know, as far as, you know, not just like the, you know, the McCarthyist stuff before you or I were born, but even going into like the, God, what would that be, like the early 70s when Ronald Reagan was the governor of California and he was trying to get Angela Davis fired from the University of California for being a communist. Up through a lot of you know, a lot that I think is much more you know, is much more recent than that. I think there are things you can point to certainly during the war, like not that it's over, but the era in which the war on terror was a defining issue, Bill Maher, who I'm certainly not a fan of, but, you know, losing his network TV show for saying something that I thought was obviously true, but registered badly in a moment of patriotic fervor. I remember Ari Fleischer is the White House press secretary talking about that. So you have to be careful what you say, you know, like they think there was definitely an atmosphere of, you know, there was definitely an atmosphere of suppression then. And even now, right. Like, I think it is, I think even right now, like it is important to notice that, I think even when it comes to concerns about free speech, you know, and those issues that, that whereas I do think there are like real concerns about things that come out of progressive censoriousness, you know, I'm also not sure how that, you know, like, I think that, you know, I think both things are true. I think all that stuff that you're talking about, I think is real, it's worrying, it's not good, right? You know, but at the same time, I can absolutely see the point that would be made by somebody who could sit here and say, well, hold on, you know, what about, the, you know, Trump sending the Department of Homeland Security to Portland to intimidate protesters. You know, what about, you know, the many times during the you know, post George Floyd unrest, you know, when there were protesters or journalists, you know, who were beaten up by the police. And I think that's all true. I think those are bigger threats in the greater scheme of things. I guess I just think I would think of like the, if you ever saw the movie Lady Bird from a few years ago, there's a line in there where the main character, you know, she's about to, in the process of breaking up with her boyfriend, who's a Chomsky reading leftist. And she starts to complain about how he's handled the relationship. And he starts telling her how many people died in Iraq. And she says, yeah, but more than one thing can be bad. Right. You know, so I think that you can acknowledge that all these other things are worse and more significant, but also say that that doesn't mean that this other thing is a non-issue or not something we should worry about.
You know, when I was getting ready for this call, I thought, well, I'll go to his, I'll go read some of his Jacobin, you know, columns.
Yeah.
And then I discovered that my attention span is just not what it used to be. I said, well, maybe I'll just check out his Twitter feed. I did read your review of a 5-year-old book by John mm-hmm. Ronson, a book yep. I've read and which I love. It's So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about the issues, you know, that book covers already. And I'd be curious as to what prompted you to write a review of a 5-year-old book.
So the immediate answer is that I was prompted to write it because Micah Utrecht, who's the deputy editor at Jacobin, asked if I wanted to write it. So that's the that was the immediate reason. But I think that the reason beyond that, I think probably the reason, you know, he was thinking about that is because I've written other things about the same cluster of topics. So he thought mm-hmm. that this might be an interesting way for me to write something for Jacobin that was generally about all of that.
Had you read the book before?
I did. Yeah. Oddly enough, I'd read it for the first time not very long before that. But yes, I did. But I had read it. I've been thinking, like I said, I've been thinking and writing about the more general issue. And I think that the, you know, I guess I'll just take the opportunity to shamelessly plug. I have a book coming out next year is in part about all of this, right? It's called Canceling Comedians While the World Burns, a critique of the contemporary left from Zero Books. And I think maybe because of the attention that had gotten when, you know, it's actually funny because like I signed the contract to write this book like a year ago at this point, and I think I finished the first draft in like March and whatever, right? And I did that annoying thing that writers do where at every step of the process, you know, I'd like tweet about it. It's like, oh yeah, I just got the, you know, this stage, whatever, approved, you know, for the book. But then, and you know, didn't really get that much attention at any stage of that. But then when they had sent me the cover file and I posted the cover on Twitter, it's like, hey, the cover of my new book is up. And, you know, and I figured like, you know, 20 people would like that or whatever. And that's when Twitter like really noticed the existence of it and got mad at me for having written it on the basis of the title. And there was a like,
you can't criticize the left from the left. That's not allowed.
Yeah, apparently not. My late friend Michael Brooks had a really good line on this on the weekend show he used to do with Anna Kasparian, where he said that thinking that you're against the left because you're, you know, critiquing part of what's doing as being self-defeating and counterproductive is like saying that a basketball coach who makes his team do drills is against the team. Which I think is exactly right. But yeah, so anyway, so that whole kerfuffle had happened, and then Bhaskar Sunkara, the main editor at Jacobin, had asked me to do a presentation kind of about the general issue on their since the beginning of the pandemic. They kind of changed the format since then, but they were doing the stay at home series on the YouTube channel since March, and so they invited me to do one of those on there. And then I think that's probably what gave Micah the idea to write a review essay about the book and about kind of what's changed in the last 5 years, you know, and all of that. But it's, you know, which I was happy to do, happier when I saw that John Ronson, who wrote the book, you know, quote tweeted it and said some nice things about it, which I was relieved by, you know, because there was a section of it, you know, that wasn't, you know, yeah, there was a section of it that was critical, you know, about the book. Overall, mm-hmm. I think it's very good, you know, but you know, I think that the one part where I did say that I think that it's I think that Ronson is really, really good at narrating events like in an entertaining and engaging way,
and narrating his own consciousness, like how he can be aware of things, you know, what the process was. Yeah,
in particular narrating his own experience of those events, right? That's what he's really good at, and he is really good at it. It's very entertaining to read, but then the problem is that because he knows that he's really good at it, sometimes he does that, I think, in places where he should be doing something else, right? So there are parts of So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which is a good book. I mean, I think it's the best thing that's been written about the larger phenomenon, you know, of what, you know, I think maybe shortly after the book came out, people were calling, you know, call out culture for a minute, and now they generally call cancel culture, which is a phrase that I think is, you know, I'll use it because I generally prefer to argue about things than about what labels we apply to them. But it's a very imperfect phrase for what it's meant to convey, because it leads to all of these really tedious arguments about like what counts as being canceled, and, you know, and is this or that count as it, you know, as canceling? Do you have to not have a career anymore? And I think all of that kind of misses the point about the larger thing that people are objecting to when they talk about it. But in any case, I think it's still the best thing that's been written on that. But my objection would just be that there are parts of it where I wish that he'd kind of taken a step back to develop his argument a little bit more clearly about, okay, what exactly are you saying? Like, you know, where is this coming from? You know, and what if anything can be done about it? And those are things that you kind of get in a sideways way in different points in the book. But I did wish that he would address it head on a little bit more. But overall, I really recommend that people read that book.
The book certainly has a point of view, but it's not a polemic. And, you know, he is a reporter. He's not a philosopher.
That's true.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, your criticism as a philosopher is that he's approaching this as a reporter, you know, and not really constructing a cohesive, overarching argument throughout the book. But, you know, as I say, he does have a point of view, and it's a very simple one. Yeah. It's like, look, this behavior, while intoxicating and tempting, is destructive. Please notice. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. Like, and again, I think he's 100% right about that. I think there is a lot of the book that's spent kind of, you know, in a weird way. I now want to harp on this too much because I like the book, you know, but like in a weird way, sometimes it feels less like you're watching a movie than like you're watching the behind the scenes documentary about the movie.
Right. Which might be more entertaining than the movie.
No, that's true. Sometimes it is, you know, but like a lot of what he's narrating is kind of his process of researching the topic and trying to figure out what's going on and all of that stuff. And so, you know, maybe it's just, you know, disciplinarily inappropriate, you know, expectations, but what I sort of wanted was, okay, and as a result of all this, what I figured out is, right?
Here is my conclusion.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, I'm going to cut in just a little bit of John Ronson's voice right now, because he is in a category along with, Terrence McKenna and, David Sedaris, and who else am I thinking of? William S. Burroughs, where, yeah, they can put words down on the page, great, but it really comes alive when you hear them read it in their own voice, particularly because their voice is not a polished, you know, professional presenter's voice, it's a very idiosyncratic voice, you know, and in like McKenna's case is, you know, it's very nasal like this. And, you know, he sounds like he should have surgery for that, like I did. And John Ronson's voice is just so soft and so high pitched and so unchallenging, you know. So I absolutely love his delivery as well as, you know, how he puts words together on the page.
I said, I wonder if some other fellow long-term sufferers also feel weirdly calm. My theory is that we rehearse catastrophic what-if situations in our heads so often when a real crisis happens, we're quite good at it. And I mean, I've suffered from anxiety for 25 years, and I have noticed this. I catastrophize about the most ridiculous things that will never happen. And then when a real crisis happens, I'm calm and focused. I know exactly what to do. So I tweeted that.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
So as I say, I started off on Jacobin and got lazy and went to Twitter. And one of the first things I discovered from your Twitter feed is that Glenn Greenwald has exited The Intercept. Would you summarize that?
So this is something that's happened extremely recently before we talked. So what I can give you is my understanding of like the first couple hours of what we of what we know about this. I expect, you know, that
we're recording this late in the day on Thursday, October 29th, 2020. The election is a few breaths away.
That's right. And so actually, funnily enough, this morning I was listening to the Joe Rogan episode a couple of episodes ago where he interviews Greenwald while I made breakfast, and then I got on Twitter and I saw this and I read the article, and I've read some of what's, like I said, I'm sure it's a developing story, as they say. I'm sure that various people will have their say and it'll complicate things in various ways. But the basic thing that happened is that Glenn Greenwald, who, you know, when I started reading him, he was writing for Salon. And then he was at The Guardian for a long time. He was at The Guardian when he published the Snowden revelations and about NSA spying. And then several years ago, he actually helped co-found this media company, The Intercept. And has done some great stuff there, particularly in exposing some of the shenanigans in Brazil having to do with the prosecution of the former president Lula da Silva, which you know, there was stuff that was leaked to them that, you know, that Glia Greenwald published, showing that was a very, you know, corrupt and politically motivated process. All of which is just to say, right? Because I know that a lot of times when people have takes on some figure like this, it's very much about like however they figure into the politics of the moment, right? You know, what TV shows are they going on? What are they saying about whatever everybody's concerned with this week? But you know, this is part of, you know, why, you know, I really admire Glenn Greenwald, that he actually does. I don't always agree with him. I think he always makes interesting arguments, but he also, you know, I think he's also done like genuinely courageous things as an investigative journalist. And part of the idea behind The Intercept was that he and his co-founders were going to have more editorial freedom there than they would have at old media outlets, you know, like The Guardian.
And for a time they did.
And for a time they did, and then they didn't. That's basically what happened. That would be the very short version. The slightly longer version would be, well, like I think there have been some signs for a little while that something not great might have been going on there over the summer. Li Fang, as a journalist at The Intercept, was accused of racism, basically for the way, you know, really it was for some like article that he did where he was quoting someone who I think was a black man in Minneapolis. Don't quote me on that, right? But you know, but who was talking about street crime and why people care less about that than they do about police violence. And the fact that he was like highlighting this, he was accused by his colleague. And I think that was part of it. And then part of it was him sort of, you know, tweeting, or maybe he wrote something for The Intercept about this, you know, about peaceful protests, you know, being more effective than riots. And whatever you think about his takes on all these issues, and, you know, and probably if we like got into the nitty gritty, I, you know, agree with some of them, disagree with others, but there did seem to be something very weird going on there where it seemed like after some of his colleagues got mad at him about this stuff, the media company itself, First Look Media, you know, the Intercept's owner, seemed to be very much siding with the critics, and he was kind of allowed to stay because he apologized for some of this, and the whole thing I think left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. But then, like, fast forward to the present, to this week, the issue with Glenn Greenwald was that he had was preparing a story which I believe had a lot to do with with Hunter Biden's laptop, the whole, you know, kerfuffle surrounding that, right? And the various things that the emails on Hunter Biden's laptop showed, and I think maybe also, you know, about criticizing the way that the rest of the media had had covered this or not covered it, or, you know, in Twitter's case, suppressed coverage of it. And now I haven't read the article. I think he's putting it out now on his own Substack, but since all this happened within the last few hours, right, I haven't read the original article, but the issue is, you know, because some people are saying, oh, you know, Glenn is like crying censorship, but really, you know, this is just editorial standards or something like that, right? You know, like he doesn't have a legitimate complaint here.
But he, as I published the email exchange with the editors, I started to read that before I talked to you. So it's not a he said, she said. Like,
yeah, we could just tell what happened, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can just read the email exchange, and it's very clear that the editors at The Intercept would not print anything that legitimized the idea that Joe Biden exercised poor judgment in allowing his son to make millions of dollars trading on the name of the sitting vice president.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the larger issue too, even outside of what you think about that story and what it says about the Bidens, is that while it's certainly true in general that that editors deciding, you know, what stories they want to run or making decisions about, you know, about how, like, how to change stories before they're run, right, like, isn't necessarily an illegitimate thing, right? You know, I have, you know, if you looked at my email exchanges with editors, you know, there are things, you know, you can find articles that are rejected. You can find, you know, you could find articles that are changed, sometimes in ways that made them much better, sometimes in ways that I thought made them worse. Right. But that's all fine, except that the whole point of The Intercept was supposed to be to really like unleash these guys, right? These journalists who are founding it. And Glenn Greenwald's particular contract, right, his employment contract with them, you know, according to him, and if, you know, like, I haven't seen the denial of this, right, you know, right. Which I think is something, you know, he insisted on, even, you know, previous employees, places of employment, really is supposed to give him a lot of latitude to pursue whatever stories he wants to pursue. And there's actually not supposed to be any editorial interference in advance, you know, with what he's writing, except for in a couple of narrowly defined exemptions having to do with kind of new investigative journalism that's like newly uncovering things and having to do with things that might expose the company to legal liability.
Right.
Neither of which seem to apply in this case. So I think that makes the concern like that. I think that makes the language of censorship more legitimate, because it's not that this is just like a journalist having a temper tantrum because he's being edited, right? This is somebody saying, hey, we had a deal, and you're reneging on the deal for pretty transparently political reasons, which is to say that you don't want me to publish things that would be embarrassing to Biden just days before the election.
Intercept?
Yeah.
Like, that's going to swing votes. Who reads?
Yeah. I mean, it's silly. Right. But I mean, like, I think that the concern, like, I think there are basically two reasons why Intercept editors might be reluctant to do that. One of them is because, like, you know, sometimes it's, I think it's easy for anybody who does media stuff to, you know, you want to think what you're doing is important. And so, you know, they might actually have an exaggerated idea of what would happen there, that somebody's going to read a Glenn Greenwald article and change their vote or decide not to vote, maybe. I don't think that there are a lot of swing voters in Pennsylvania, you know, who are hanging on the every word of the Intercept, but I think that might be part of it. But I think another part of it is just like, if you don't want to, like, I think it really might just be as simple as not wanting people who you might like or respect or are in your professional circles, you know, that you just don't want them to get mad at you. And, right. and you know that if you're publishing things days before a presidential election that everybody is extremely emotionally invested in, that could be seen as undermining, you know, Biden's chances of victory, then people get mad at you. And so far, I haven't seen anything to lead me to believe that some combination of those two things weren't their motivation. Because otherwise it seems like, well, if there's something where you can say, hey, here's like a really specific factual claim that you're making, and here's why it's wrong, and here's how you could change it, then okay, fair enough. You know, he might still have a legitimate complaint if it violates his contract, but on some level, fair enough. But in this case, at least based on, you know, I read his initial Substack post where he laid out what happened to him as his understanding of it. And I read the response that was going around from the editor-in-chief of The Intercept. And at least based on those two pieces of evidence, it's, you know, nothing in the response made me think that this isn't what was going on there.
I'm a lifelong NPR listener. And I got irritated with NPR right after, like in the year after 9/11. Because they were beating the drums for war like everybody else. And I really hated that. But in general, I like NPR. I like their take. But man, as soon as Trump took office, I mean, it's gotten worse over time, but the change was immediate. They just started telling you how you're supposed to feel about their news stories. And it's in the headline. You know, it's like it's in, or maybe the subhead. Like anytime there's a mention of Hunter Biden, you know, like I listen to like 10 minutes of NPR every day on my flash briefing from the Amazon device, whose name I will not mention so she doesn't wake up. Anytime there's a mention of Hunter Biden, or, you know, the possibility that maybe he did something inappropriate, which might reflect poorly on Joe Biden, they always describe it as the discredited conspiracy theory that Joe Biden did this and this. Or, you know, that Hunter Biden worked for Burisma. I mean, they tell you in the headline what your opinion is.
Yeah, did you have you read Matt Taibbi's book, Hate Inc.?
I have not, no. Okay. I generally like Matt Taibbi, though.
Yeah, well, I read it not that long ago. I really liked it a lot. He talks about this in there. It's a good... he originally envisioned it as an update of Chomsky and Herman's Manufacturing Consent, to sort of think about, okay, what's changed in the decades since then? You know, we don't have the Cold War, all that, right? And And that's still to some extent how the book ended up, but it ended up covering much broader territory. And a lot of it is about the way that the media landscape has changed and segmented. And in particular in the Trump era, and he gets into a lot of stuff like this, that like, you know, like they don't like media outlets that I guess in some sort of overcorrection for the way that I think there was a failing that the media in general maybe like propped Trump up early on by you know, giving him this like, you know, obsessive, you know, like obsessively covering yep. everything that he did, because
isn't
know, because
he terrible was... isn't he terrible, let us tell you 12 hours a day how terrible.
yeah
heard
yeah,
his voice in the last 2 minutes, here it is.
Yeah, because he's the most entertaining game in town, so why wouldn't you, right? It's good for ratings. But then I think, you know, then I think people felt bad about it. And at any rate, there was a lot of backlash about it. And especially because we're in a much more, you know, we live in a much more segmented, you know, media landscape. Everybody can pick the media, you know, that conforms to what they want.
Yep.
You just get to order it a la carte, you know, in a way that certainly back in the era that you were talking about, in the 80s, right? I mean, you watch what was on TV, and yeah. that was your choice. Whereas now, you know, you can really, you know, you can really just consume a diet. Like there's so many different news sources you can pick, you know, like you, yeah. you know, you said, you know, you watch Rising every day, you know, like that's on YouTube. everybody can pick their own media. And so I think that also makes media companies much more liable to capture by their customer base, and so if there's a feeling that they maybe like were part of the problem in 2016, then like they'll do this thing to overcorrect for it, where they'll like paternalistically tell people what they should think about a story as they're giving you the story, which I mean, all I can, you know, which of course just makes the problem even worse, because then you know, anybody who actually like anybody who's listening to NPR, who, you know, who like, if there are such people, right, you know, anybody's listening to NPR, you know, who might support Trump or buy his narrative of events, you know, would listen to what you're talking about and say, yeah, okay, well, these guys aren't even trying to hide it, right? They're clearly, you know, they're clearly just like giving me news from the other team, you know, like that, like they're, yeah. they're giving me the other team's perspective on it as they're giving it to me, which, so, I mean, I think it even destroys the point, because it's going to be less effective to anybody who might be like, you know, if you're going to have a spin, right. I mean, like you got to make it subtler than that, or it's not going to do any good.
You know, every now and again, I think, okay, I'm going to listen to some, what's the network that Rachel Maddow's on?
MSNBC,
right. Sometimes I think, okay, I'm going to watch MSNBC and Fox today.
Yeah.
Just to see what they're saying. And I can't bring myself to do it. You know, for me, the exercise in media balance is just to go outside the U.S., like, every day my flash briefing starts off with BBC, then there's NPR, and then there's Al Jazeera. And the striking difference between the three is that starting off with the BBC, there will be multiple international stories. There'll be stories about things happening in Africa. You wouldn't even know that Africa exists if you just listen to NPR. You know, so you'll hear a bunch of international stories on BBC, then comes on NPR, and really it's all just the election. It's just every single story is about how terrible Donald Trump is, how he's Hitler incarnate, and how, you know, the world is going to burn if Joe Biden isn't elected. And then comes Al Jazeera, and suddenly it's an international news, you know, it's an offering of international stories again. So I don't recall NPR always being just so hyper-focused on, you know, the domestic scene the way that, you know, Fox News is.
Yeah.
And I don't know when that transition took place. I think it was before 2016, though.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I mean, my experience of NPR is that I listened to it I listened to it a great deal while I was growing up because I grew up in a household where it was on all the time. Mm-hmm. And then, not very much at all after that. Cause I'd, you know, I would occasionally, like, over the years, right, you know, I'll occasionally put it on if I'm in the car and, you know, and I want news and, you know, whatever, like sometimes I'll stick it on,
right,
for a few minutes. But I think that in my, you know, I think my particular sort of, rebellion, you know, was, you know, was that if I was listening to the radio, you know, 95% of the time it would be music.
Right.
But
music your parents didn't like, probably.
Sure. But yeah, look, I mean, I think that I can't speak too much to NPR. I mean, I've certainly seen this in other mainstream outlets. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, MSNBC has obviously been aggressively pushing, you know, like pursuing this niche as the Democratic Party, you know, news organ.
The Blue Fox.
Yeah. Blue. Yeah. Like it's been doing the Blue Fox thing for many years. Like there was a point where it wasn't.
I think that was Keith Olbermann. I think his ranting was so successful that they just said, "Hey, here's a formula.
Let's just run with this." That's right. I think that's right. Cause it was like, I think it was after Keith Olbermann got big where they did that like rebranding with was it Lean Forward or whatever it was, you know? That,
I don't follow. Yeah. I liked Keith Olbermann. I watched his stuff and that's all.
So. You know, I'll say this about Keith Olbermann. I did like him for a while during the Bush years. You know, I enjoyed his rants and his, you know, good night and good luck shtick, you know? And then there was a point later on where I think lacking Bush as, you know, I mean, not that anything he said about him was wrong, but like lacking Bush as the kind of central hate figure.
Yeah.
I think that the commentary got a lot less, you know, entertaining to me, and it was, I think maybe some of the flaws were more evident, but what I actually really did like was when Olbermann briefly went back to ESPN, because he did a sports talk show that was in the same format as his old MSNBC show, like right down to, I think he did like a sports version of his worst person in the world segment, you know, there's like the whole thing. And so I was like, oh, actually this I kind of like, because you know, the format I always found really entertaining, you know, I always found Keith Olbermann's persona really entertaining. It's just that like that sort of, like the extremely predictable, like liberal Democratic talking points, but just like angrier than Maddow. I kind of got sick of, but if he kept the ESPN show, I'd probably still be watching that now. Unfortunately, my guess is that Keith Olbermann must be the most difficult person in the world to work with, because he only seems to keep every job for like 6 months each.
Yeah. You know, there's the time travel fantasies of, oh, if I could go back and do this and change that, you know, and of course everybody wants to go kill Hitler, but maybe right. more compassionate people would say, well, what if we could go back and get Hitler into that art school that he applied to?
Right. You know? Right.
I think Rush Limbaugh really wanted to be like an ESPN sportscaster. Like that was his vision. And if only we could go back in time and get him that job. Let him talk about football.
Yeah, absolutely.
He'd be happy. We'd all be spared his decades-long crusade against rationality.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, obviously, like I feel about Rush Limbaugh's actual career, you know, pretty much the way you'd expect me to. You know, I mean, I pretty much think he's a piece of shit. But in that alternate timeline, I might even enjoy the show, you know, like, yeah. cause I've like hate listened to enough Rush Limbaugh over the years to like have a sense that he's actually like a very talented broadcaster. He's kind of fun to listen to.
Oh yeah.
You know? So if he was doing that without the rabid right-wing content, then yeah, I'd probably listen to that. I totally, you know, listen to Rush Limbaugh talking about football.
Well, hey, we've been on for about an hour. Let me offer you the final word. What should we take away from our friendly chat here?
Yeah, the the media landscape is very bad. It's not getting any better. Even though this does tie into, even though I'm part of the problem here, you know, because I was just mentioned that maybe it's not great that everybody gets to like order a la carte the media diet they want. Mm-hmm. I think that you're still probably better off steering clear of mainstream, you know, news sources and watching stuff, like The Rising or Majority Report or, you know, my own humble podcast, Give Them an Argument. I guess as far as a lot of the rest of it, I think that this is one of those things that's just mind-numbingly obvious, but maybe it should be mind-numbingly obvious. when you feel tempted to start like berating somebody for their political unrighteousness, you know, maybe like stop and think about whether the effect of this is going to actually be to convince them of anything or to bring them back into the fold or whether maybe they're going to say screw you and go start listening to the people who hate you because they think they must have a point. I think if you just, yeah, I'm not saying never yell at anybody, but if you just do that spot check, you know, I think that would go a long way.
And there's always going to be somebody wrong on the internet.
Yes.
You have to be able to take a deep breath, let it out, and close the laptop, put the phone down, turn around and attend to something real and not dwell on it. That's my issue. You know, is even when I close the laptop and put the phone down, it's still just replaying in my mind, you know.
I know.
Bad. It's bad.
It is. It's really bad. I have not come up with a good solution yet in my own cases, in my own case for how to, use social media just enough to, you know, get the word out about what I'm doing and to emotionally disentangle myself from everything else that goes on there. But I know I'd be better off if I did. So I hope if there's a similar amount of time between now and the next time we talk as was between now and the last time we talked, I really hope that by then I'll be like, oh yeah, dude, dude,
I've totally sussed it. I found the right meditation protocol.
Yeah, that's right. I have, I'm on Twitter for 2 minutes a day and then I sit Zazen for a while, and then I'm good, you know? I think that probably won't happen, but I really hope it does.
Good luck with that.
All right. Thanks, man.
All right. Take care, Ben.
On the C-ROM podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back never to go its back, old dimensions. Back.
Okay, friends, that was my most recent conversation with Ben Burgess. I put out a video a while back, and I haven't been doing YouTube videos much recently, other than my daily live stream, which is just focused on drawing, really. But back when I was still doing videos fairly regularly, when the Biden campaign announced Kamala Harris as the running mate, I put out a video saying, Kamala Harris, really? Fine, I'm voting for Trump. Well, I couldn't really bring myself to do it. I voted by mail a couple weeks ago. I voted for Howie Hawkins, the Green Party candidate. And I didn't really mention this in the recorded interview with Ben, but this is a source of frustration for me. I live in Vermont. It is possibly the bluest state in the nation. My vote doesn't count here. It just does not count. And another thing that's kind of frustrating is that while it's a solidly Democrat state, there's a progressive Democrat running for governor against a Republican. You'd think in a solidly blue state that the progressive Democrat, come on, in Vermont, would have an edge over the Republican, but it really looks like our Republican governor, Phil Scott, will coast to an easy re-election victory over David Zuckerman. David Zuckerman, you know, if you've been listening for a while, you'll probably recognize his name and his voice. I've interviewed him a couple times. I'd really like for him to be the governor of this state, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen. And you know, when it comes to a presidential candidate, never in my 52 years of life have I ever voted for the winner. So for all you righteous vote shamers out there, or voter shamers, you don't want me on your team. I'm cursed. No, that's getting the causality backwards. I always vote for somebody that I know has no chance of winning. And 2020 is no different. All right, well, I'm not going to ramble on here because, well, there's a new episode of Star Trek Discovery to watch. And so far, season 3, fingers crossed, knock on wood, it's been okay. I really want to like Star Trek. I do. I know. Most of you don't care. So I'll stop talking about it and do what little editing I'm going to do and get this up so you can listen to it. And I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.